Hello, well, we were just discussing how my taste in movies should not
to the
be
after
trusted.
After
Sorry.
The show after the show. It's okay. We're not at 100 of these yet, so we don't have the flow down.
We got time.
The show after the show where we talk about things after the show. I was alluding to Edge of Tomorrow, a.k.a. Live, Die, Repeat. I'm pretty sure it's Edge of Tomorrow. Live, Die, Repeat is definitely the catchphrase because that makes so much more sense. Edge of Tomorrow was such a better theme. Me and my boyfriend watched this last night for the first time ever. It's honestly pretty good.
It's so good.
I was led to believe that this was a bad film, and I was lied to. People were like, oh my god, Edge of Tomorrow. I'd only ever heard it be clowned on. No, it's just a good movie. It's got a weird, I think the ending is the weakest part, but it's really well paced up till then. And as someone who notes editing especially, I was wildly impressed with the way they chose to construct this film.
I think it would be very impressive from an editor perspective, because they've got to be doing that standard time loop thing where everything that he's not directly involved in is happening exactly the same way over and over again, right?
Yeah,
that's got to be a huge pain in the ass to do right.
It's such a good movie.
I think they do it in a really clever way because they kind of imply that he's going through loops rather than showing you every single instance of it, which is very smart because it lets you imagine that he's done this hundreds of thousands of times, right? And a couple points in the film, they leverage it for a dramatic reveal. It's we don't realize that this is either the first time he's gotten to a certain point or time has passed. And this is the 100th time he's gotten to a certain point in his run through of whatever. And it's really effective. It's well written and well edited. And I was like, what are people talking about? what did I know about this? This is a really well executed sci-fi concept and it's very charming.
I don't know what happened when this movie was released, but either the marketing was just not existent or what, because it did not perform very well and basically immediately became a cult classic when it hit DVD.
Yeah.
I think they changed the title of the film either partway through the theatrical run or between
theater
release and when I went to DVD.
Looking at posters that said Edge of Tomorrow and thinking in my head, I was younger, but being that's the movie is called Edge of Tomorrow. And only after it hit theaters did I hear people saying oh no, is it Live, Die, Repeat? And I'm like, it can't be. That's such a dumb title compared to Edge of Tomorrow, which is the obvious title. Yeah. But I've only ever heard it referenced in reference to the title nonsense and not, this is actually a really nice, well-done sci-fi movie.
It's such a good movie. The concept is simple but really clever. The execution is
so
fantastic.
Well.
It's a perfect Tom Cruise vehicle.
He
was not born to play this role. Maverick and Ethan Hunt, first in line, obviously.
Mm-hmm,
but he is such a good pick for this character. And opposite Emily Blunt,
She's
the pairing I would have made, but such a good combo between the two of them.
I'm going to have to watch this because...
You should. I think you would. I think this is a movie that you would like. It's very... It reminded me a lot of Pacific Rim in executing a genre concept.
Yeah.
I think... I've referenced it. I've seen parts of it, and I've brought it up in Trope Talks on occasion. I try not to overly reference things I haven't watched all the way through, just because I like formulating my own opinion on things.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that I won't summarize something I haven't read for myself, because then I would just be photocopying a photocopy, summarizing a summary. But I think the reason why I need to watch this is because I'm starting to think that I should probably look into time loops as a specific Trope Talk beyond just time travel, because it's one of those things where the subcategory of the trope is a completely different genre than the main trope. Like, time travel stories, that's one thing. Time loop stories, those are all existential hells. That is 100% of time loop stories. And I think that's something I got to explore. There's a game that came out semi-recently, an indie game called In Stars and Time, and it is so profoundly impactful. There is a fully voiced playthrough that Jellapocalypse and some of his crew did that I watched through, and it was one of those things where it's once I finished it, I needed to stare at the wall for a few hours to just kind of a process. But it's the premise of it is basically it is a game. You are playing the party rogue in a JRPG style crew of heroes. You are about to confront the big boss. You are going into his evil castle. You miss a trap and you get crushed by a rock and die. You wake up in the starting field. Your character knows what just happened. Nobody else does, but your character knows what just happened and attempts to find a way to break out of the loop. It's maybe I need to beat the final boss. You beat the final boss. The game resets. It's not good enough. Okay, so what do you need to do? He's like, well, maybe I need to, they're like, maybe I need to get through to all my teammates. Maybe I need to fulfill all of their personal goals. Maybe that will let me out of this loop. nope. and there's a lot of games like this. It's kind of like, in the same vein as Hades, it is a game that intentionally acknowledges the frustration of replaying the same thing over and over and over again, in that, like, it's easier to bear as the player because the character is also going through it and doesn't particularly like it. Like, every time you die stupid in Hades and then Zagreus walks out of the blood pool like fucking skeletons, it's just like, yeah, Zag, you and me both, we're on the same page here. Rather than you feeling frustrated with the game, it feels like the game is right there with you. And in Stars and Time kind of does that too, where it's like, you, the player, might not like having to do this over and over and over again, but Sifrin, the character, also really doesn't like having to do this over and over again, and their mental health is rapidly deteriorating because of it. And they're specifically going through that specific nightmare when you're replaying a game over and over again of, like, the characters that I thought of as vibrant and complete beings are becoming flattened caricatures as their dialogue gets looped over and over again, and I see the limits of what their characterization is capable of, because they aren't actually complete people, they're just code, and I've run out of their library of lines. But in the context of the game, these are real people, and this is just Sifrin basically slowly going insane, because it's like, I can't tell my friends what's happening to me, and I have to see them play this out over and over and over and over and over again, and it doesn't feel real to me anymore, and the real people around me are steadily becoming more and more flat and unreal to me because I can't relate to them anymore. So it really feels like a game that takes the concept of a time loop is a special kind of hell and just plays it out to its logical conclusion. And when I was watching through that, I was like, yeah, there's something to do here. There's like a trope talk to be done here. But I'm going to need to watch a lot of stuff that I don't normally like experiencing to do it. There's a few tropes that I've been holding off on for that specific reason. I like wrote up some preliminary notes on a trope talk on like came back wrong. And then I was like, I'm a giant baby about horror movies. So that kind of means that I would need to put myself through a few circles of hell to do any of the like, I need to watch fucking Pet Sematary. I need to watch Jennifer's Body. And like, I know they're all good, but I'm a huge baby about horror because horror stuff gets stuck in my head and then haunts me at 3 a.m. And it's never fun.
I think
Edge of Tomorrow, though, pretty fucking
good. Edge of Tomorrow, yeah. Fred, knowing what movies you typically like, I think you would enjoy Edge of Tomorrow. I think that
I'm pretty
for
sure,
one thing, I think it's a great execution of the time loop as a trope. I think it understands exactly what you can do with that kind of an idea, and it executes it in a way that simultaneously conveys the growing dread and exhaustion it creates on the person who is stuck in the time loop, and also doesn't make you, the viewer, get sick of seeing the world over and over again. Like, it handles when to change things very appropriately. I think the weakest part of it is, like, the last 10 minutes. It does a weird thing at the very, very end that I didn't love. But, like, other than that, it is very, very strong.
Monster design is also really good.
Monster design is really cool. They're, like,
I don't
dangerous
even know how to describe
sprites. Like, they're big, dangerous, those koosh balls, you know? They're great. They rock. And like, you know, robot suit, very cool. Emily Blunt with robot sword, very cool. So there's a lot of like, oh, yeah, moments. Yeah. But then also, you know, watching it made me really upset that since it came out in the era of the video game tie-in movie, we did not get a good roguelite Edge of Tomorrow game, because that would have ripped. It's perfectly built for a roguelite Hades style. This is the same thing repeating over and over again, and you just get better at it with each loop. Devs, if you want to get the rights to Edge of Tomorrow now and do that, it would rip so hard.
Or
I would
indie
buy
devs,
that
if you want to make something that looks suspiciously similar to Edge of Tomorrow and then just call it Live, Die, Repeat.
Yeah,
there's
right.
Every once in a while, I'll see like clippings about like Tom Cruise and director Doug Liman really want to do an Edge of Tomorrow sequel, and it's like, you know, the kind of stuff these websites just peddle every 6 months to
Edge
to get
of the
engagement.
Day
after
tomorrow.
Yeah, in this case, it came out 10 years ago. And it was like the director's like, yeah, I want to do this. And Tom Cruise keeps like texting me about it. But like, I need to find a concept first, because we can't just do a sequel the way that we wrote the first movie. Like, we need to find something.
The mental image of Tom Cruise at 3 a.m. being like, Edge of Tomorrow sequel king.
But like, that's so the Tom Cruise persona. Like, with everything we know about him, he would do that.
Yeah.
I'm sure that there's a world where they could execute it. It's one of those movies that did not make me want it to have any sequel. Or anything. I'm like, this is a This is a beautiful concept that I think is best executed on film, and I'm really glad they made it this way, because the way that film can play with time in the edit is really strong, and it worked out. It's a perfect synergy of the concept and editing of manipulation of time and the story. It worked great in that way. I don't want any more of it. I think it's good as it is, and I don't want to know anything else, because then I'm going to think about it too much, and it's going to ruin my enjoyment of this film. And I think we as a society need to kill the impulse to make more of things after they've been executed perfectly. Sometimes it's great, and sometimes it ruins the original, and I think we need to just all accept that not everything needs a sequel or a prequel trilogy or, you know, whatever it is. Like, we can all love something and then just continue to love that thing and not want more of it. And
I think nothing makes you more convinced of that than getting a bad installment of something you like, where it's like this would have been better if it just ended, you know, at season two or season three or something like that. But the thing is, I also understand the impulse. When you have something that you like, you want more of it. Like, I've been, you guys may have noticed, I've been cutting together a lot of shorts out of the old Breath of the Wild streams. And as I was going through the later parts, like, the last, like, four streams are very much in the end game, where it's just, like, I am as overleveled as I can possibly be, and I am running out of things to do. And I remember, you know, now that I've been revisiting those, like, I remember that headspace where I was like, God, I just wish this map gave me, like, more to explore, you know, more stuff to do. And then Tears of the Kingdom was like, here is exactly that. And I was like, yes, good. But in my, like, personal file on Tears of the Kingdom, I've gotten to that. I have all the shrines, I have all the light roots, and I once again ran out of things to do. And I was like, I would love it if there was more.
Yeah,
but there isn't. And then in contrast, like as mentioned, I've been playing through Hades, and I have gotten through both true endings now. I got the credits to roll, and I got the family reunion.
Yeah, right.
And then
it's
the
been
game
out for
was
a
just,
while. I feel like you're in safe territory here.
Yeah, and
the
then the game was just
is
like
in production.
Yes, and then the game was just like, yeah, continue playing. This is your job now. And I was like, okay. And it's still rolling out new dialogue, but I'm starting to find the limits. I'm starting to find the points where, like, the Olympians have started giving me fairly generic, here, take my boon dialogue, rather than... Ares is still hitting on Nyx, but I think I've reached the end of that particular dialogue tree. So now it's just going to be like, yes, cousin, take my boon. Funnest version of Ares in anything, by the way. Definitely the classiest. I can see why people were like, this version of Ares is my boy. It's pretty much a far cry from the doofus I've been doing. But... it's interesting when you can sort of feel the game run out of things for you to do. Because every game is finite. And every series is finite. Every story is finite. A good game or a story can convince you that it isn't. But the longer a game lets you linger, the easier it becomes to bump up against those edges and be like, oh, right, this is fiction and I have just about exhausted it. It turns into an analogy I've used before, chewing the same piece of gum, hoping the flavor will come back.
I think it's an interesting conversation to have in, like, video games versus any other form of media as well, because, like, in my mind with, like, a movie or, like, a book or a TV show, there is, you know, you are experiencing the story by having it told to you or, you know, reading it, watching it, however it is. You are not doing anything mechanical that makes the story happen. So when you've experienced the story, you know, it's over and you can go back and re-experience it if you want, but, like, there isn't, like, a way to artificially continue that. Without someone making more of it. And I think that that's the impulse that goes wrong. It's like, well, people loved experiencing the story this way. Let's put more in. And that's not always, sometimes it works, but like, that's not always a great impulse. But in video games, you have a very interesting interaction of like with Hades, and you can just keep doing runs with all these mechanics. It's just that the story has run out, right? Like there is something to the mechanical continuation of something is not always as enriching as it was when there was a story happening, but there are ways for you to, as a player who owns a game, like artificially continue that game ad infinitum.
Setting challenges or taking the game up on
its
own.
You know,
challenges.
The reason people do like Pokemon shiny hunts and stuff, like that's not built into the game as like a thing that you have to achieve, but like it's a way to continue the game, right? Like there are certain ways that a video game can be continued without a sequel that like other forms of media can't. But also, I think video games are one of the best places to insert sequels because the player is so deeply entrenched in whatever that story is that, like, if the gameplay is good and strong, just the story becomes a vehicle for the gameplay and player engagement as opposed to you know, watching and consuming something being a vehicle for consuming the story. And I think mm-hmm. that flip makes sequels much more successful in video games as opposed to other forms of media if, you know, the gameplay stays good. You know, if you do a Reshim of Destruction Yu-Gi-Oh! GBA game and tank your playability, then you've got a different problem. But, like, with, like, a Hades 2, like, the gameplay will probably, I assume, will be good. And therefore, mm-hmm. the story being a vehicle for me to continue to play that game series is going to be a great thing. Tears of the Kingdom, yeah. very similar thing. Like, the gameplay stayed good and you got to do what you wanted. So it's a great way to insert a sequel. And I think it's almost like lower risk sequel creation if you get good mechanics.
Well, I saw something interesting about that because a few people, now that I've mentioned that I played through Hades, there have been a few people like on my Tumblr ask box being mm-hmm. like, hey, have you played the sequel yet? Or are you going to wait until it's officially out? And it's like, I'm going to wait till it's officially out. Because I am mostly invested in the story of these games, and I know for a straight fact that you're not going to get the full story of that game just mm-hmm. by beating the bad guy once. Like, the reason why they could release it at this stage is clearly because the core gameplay loop is done. The run is done. Now they're just writing 5 million lines of dialogue and probably some extra songs. And it's like, because that's the thing. When honestly, from a programming standpoint, this is genius. Because once you code in the combat, the enemy spawns, and, like, you could probably put in, like, the difficulty, like, the Pact of Punishment stuff and code that in, you know, as an extra. But, like, the core loop, you can get that done. And then everything else is just icing. It's just, like, you code in, you can interact with characters, and they have new dialogue for you, and then you just pack in more and more dialogue trees. It's genius. So that's clearly what they're doing. That's why the dev time is still going. It's like some of the characters have unfinished art, but the gameplay is almost certainly almost all the way done, and that's why they have it released in that form. But the story could be like 10% done, and they just haven't turned on the trigger that lets you enter like true ending number one or the epilogue zone or whatever the hell mm-hmm. they're going to be doing for this one.
Yeah. From a development perspective, it's a really smart way to do it because you can essentially get the core bones of the gameplay down mm-hmm. and it's not like you're gonna add new moves or new functions of how you play. You know, you can maybe like throw in an extra weapon and test it there mm-hmm. but like the game is built. You can spend however many years you want polishing it, and then you're not even holding up the development pipeline because the story team still has to write all their stuff, and the story team's not holding up the development pipeline because the gameplay team has to polish all the combat things. Yeah. So it's mm-hmm. great because, you know, both made, I know there's a lot more to game design than just like gameplay and story, mm-hmm. but you know, like art and things like that, but like the two like biggest pillars of the game are working in parallel and just adding and adding and adding and polishing stuff. And it's great. No one's waiting around for anyone else to finish up. It's like, okay, cool, go. We have enough uh-huh. to get a test out there for people to play, and we can take that, listen to it, work on it, while the story team is still writing, you know, millions of lines of dialogue.
Yeah, and what I'm invested in is the story. I want the story of Hades too. Like, there's tons of spoilers, quote unquote, for the game now because it's like, oh, somebody found this cutscene where like this happens and like we get a glimpse of this character and that's maybe mm-hmm. where that character is. And it's like, that's where the character is at the beginning of the game. I want to know when you can unlock them and start hanging out with them or something like that. Right? Like, I want to know what the progression of the game is. And there's no way for me to know that until the game is done. So like there's no benefit for me playing other than just playing an unfinished game. So like I'm going to wait for it to be done and then I'll see how much I can get. But it has been really interesting because Hades feels really, really carefully polished to be, like, very painless for the player, weirdly. It's hard to explain. I think there might be a detailed diatribe in here somewhere if I could, like, get my thoughts in order on it. But there's so many anti-frustration measures, and I really respect that. Because the whole premise of the game is, like, there is no escape. It's all pain and suffering, and one of your two primary romances is a very BDSM relationship where you just actually kill each other as boss fights on the regs. And it's just like, okay, so it's all about, like, pain and torment. But then the game is like, hey, bud, listen, if you're having too much of a problem, you can go into the settings and turn on God mode whenever you want, and we will give you an incremental benefit to all mm-hmm. of your stats and attacks every time you die. So we won't just immediately like make you immortal, but every time you lose, you will gain a tangible benefit that will make you stronger next time. And it's just like, oh, okay. And then I compare that to my experience playing Link's Awakening, and I'm like, this game is doing the opposite of hand-holding. This game is putting out its hand and then doing the, oh, too slow. And it's interesting. It's a design principle that has changed. And we were talking about this the other night. I had some friends over, and I got them to watch the first 5 episodes of Gargoyles, which is a huge win in my book. but we were discussing my experience playing the game, and one of the things they brought up is, like, back in the day, you know, especially in the Game Boy days, like 1993 when this sucker came out, you would get one video game, and you would have that video game, and it would be your one video game for, like, a year.
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm. And from that standpoint, the design language of Link's Awakening makes perfect sense. It's like, it's so opaque because the game doesn't want you to finish it fast. It wants to reward you for checking every boulder and bombing every wall and shooting arrows into everything and digging up every scrap of land because sometimes it'll reward you.
Yeah, what you do is you go into a dungeon one night, run around for 6 hours, and the next day at school you're like, hey, friend, how the hell do you do that dungeon? And they're like, oh, you know the arrow, you bomb it, and then you do that, and then you spend another 6 hours fucking around, and the next day at school you're like, hey, buddy, what do I do after that? It's meant to be played, in a sense, collaboratively.
Yeah,
and it's
or
meant
this is
to...
a big reason that there's a lot of popularity for, like, game guides that would be in, like, you know, Nintendo Life Magazine or whatever, or, like, you could go to GameStop and you could buy a game guide, not just a game. Like, these were very popular for a reason.
There's an old Donkey video where he talks about bullshit hard games from, like, the 80s and 90s where, like, they're trying to pad the playtime. So, like, in the old Ninja Gaiden games, like, enemies just spawn out of nowhere and just kill you, and it's like, deal with it, fucker.
Get good, bitch.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what's so interesting is that, like, modern video games, it feels like, go out of their way to intentionally avoid that feeling. And I think it's because, and then this came up in the conversation I was having, if you get frustrated with a game now, you have so many other games you can choose from. You don't need to keep banging your head against the wall that is this game. And, like, so now, you know, people go out of their way to choose that. Like, it'll be a point of pride of, like, I am a Dark Souls player. The game fucking slaps me in the face, and I say, thank you, sir, may I have another? And it's just, like, great, amazing. But that's, like, an intentional choice, a point of pride, even. And people who don't do that are told, well, you gotta get good, otherwise you're not gonna get anything out of it. You're just gonna be annoyed because the game keeps slapping you. But that's... A lot of games will just not do that. You get, like, cozy games. You get shit like, you know, Animal Crossing New Horizons, where it's just like, this is here because we're 3 months into a global pandemic and you need something.
Animal Crossing should be meaner, though. Animal Crossing used to be mean.
It came out the same week as lockdown.
Yeah. Well, yes.
Could not have come at a better time.
You're right. Sorry. I cracked 3 months into lockdown and bought a Switch Lite for the express purpose of playing Animal Crossing New Horizons.
I did something very similar. I think it was right at the beginning of the lockdown that I also bought a Switch Lite and was like, we'll play Animal Crossing on it. But also, Animal Crossing used to be meaner on the GameCube edition.
Yeah, Animal Crossing used to be
villagers
mean.
Villagers were rude to you constantly, and now they are too nice, and it takes some of the bite out of the game, but that's a wider conversation.
Yeah, and, like, as somebody who basically did not grow up playing video games, like, you know, I played, like, Super Smash Bros. With my cousins. They had Skyward Sword on the Wii, and I played that a few times and was not impressed. Fun fact, I was pretty good at the combat in that game, but not the boss fights. My sister was really good at the boss fights because the way she played was she would hold the Wiimote and jump up and down in a panic. Girahim didn't know what the fuck to do with that. She just beat him every time. Just immediately. So that's the pro gamer strat. If you're stuck on the Girahim boss fights, jump up and down and flail wildly and it will succeed. Because it's an interesting bit of design. Like, legitimately, most of the game is set up to teach you, like, the direction. They'll telegraph the attack coming this way, so you got to hold the Wiimote to parry it the other way. But then Girahim will fake you out. Like, you've trained yourself to do one thing, and what are you going to do? So if you're really good at the boss fight, you're probably going to be bad at most of the rest of the game. But
I almost bought a refurbished Wii over the weekend. I very impulsively was looking at my local GameStop's website, and I was like, I can get a Wii for like $50.
Whoa, really?
I know, right? I was like,
I gotta get
something
to let me play Twilight Princess on God.
That's the thing. I'm like, I know there are emulators, but like.
Maybe
what if
I just
had
hold out
the,
for
I want
the Switch
remote 2. In my
hold
hand.
Out for the Switch 2. Who knows what they're going to announce for the start of that thing.
Yeah, if they let it be backwards compatible, then all will be forgiven, and I'll take the Switch 2, and I'll get to hang out with my girl Midna again.
This,
but
like,
if they don't,
of, like, remastering or porting the Zelda games to the Switch gives me, a long-time suffering Fire Emblem fan, the faintest hope that maybe they'll, like, remaster or, like, port some of the old games over. Because, like, the Ike's games, Red Your Boy.
Radiant
were on
Dawn?
The Wii. They were on the Wii. It was Radiant Dawn and Path of Radiance. I'm like, nice. you could put those on the Switch so easily, though. but alas, no luck.
Yeah.
I will say on the subject of, like, you know, you had one game and that was your game for months. Like, I know it was aggressively like that in the early days of console gaming and home PC gaming, where, like, consoles were expensive. Games were expensive. Like, adjusted for inflation, like, a game would cost, like, multiple $100s. Consoles were, like, $1,000 adjusted for inflation. Jeez. And, like, even still in our childhoods, not as much, but, like, still, like, I had a handful of games that I played over and over and over again. Mm. I played the Uncharted games a whole bunch of times. I played Dishonored a whole bunch of times. I played Assassin's Creed a whole bunch of times. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, nowadays there are so many games that are coming out, and I'm like, this is too much. I have like four games that I want to play in a year, and that's like the max for me right now. Like there's CatQuest 3 just came out. There's Echoes of Wisdom, and then there's the new Astrobot game. I'm like, this is almost too much. And these are three like probably smaller games.
The weird thing is, console memory requirements are not keeping up with that. Like, no. When I installed Link's Awakening for the stream, I had to like delete my my downloaded data for Breath of the Wild or something. Like, my save data is still in there, but it was like 16 gigs, and I needed to delete it because otherwise I wouldn't have space. I really only have room for four or five games on there at a time, and there's more games I want to play. And it's just, it's really interesting to me. I don't know. It's kind of cool rediscovering this, because again, I was very insulated away from, like, video games when I was, you know, little. And even then, like, we didn't have any consoles in the house. Like, my dad would play computer games sometimes. Like, he would play Diablo and Neverwinter Nights and stuff like that. So I knew those existed. I'd occasionally play Age of Mythology on my uncle's computer when I went over and visited them. But console games.
The Age of Mythology is coming out this year too. What the fuck?
Oh my gosh, I've been hoping, like, I want to find a way to play Age of Mythology because I feel like that would just be the perfect hit of nostalgia to just ruin me for a whole week. But it is always just interesting to me to like go back and rediscover our our fandom roots, as it were. And on that note, I did watch all 13 episodes of the 1989 animated Legend of Zelda cartoon. Which was a fascinating experience. It's the origin of the princess. Yeah. It's so fascinating. I watched it with Magenta. I was on a whim. I was like, hey, do you want to watch this? And she was like, yes. And then the next day she was like, we should put that back on. And I was like, I'm glad you said it, because otherwise I would have felt like the asshole. I definitely had more fun with it than she did. She was mostly just like, this is bad and stupid. But there's some interesting stuff in there, mostly from a, I guess, anthropological standpoint, because it came out in 1989, which was very much in the, like, peak, we must localize everything as far as it will go era. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, it was definitely, like, an American-made production. It wasn't, like, a dub of an anime or something like that. It was a Western cartoon, very He-Man-looking in a lot of ways, and very much like, well, the kids at home aren't going to understand a silent protagonist or a princess with, like, this personality. So it's very strange because, you know, nowadays, it's a Breath of the Wild, Tears of the Kingdom, were fucking record-breaking. They did gangbusters. Everybody likes that version of Zelda where she's kind of this, like, insecure nerd, very much in over her head, you know, just doing her best, but also has the power of 1,000 suns, which is always a fun character combination. And then you watch this, and they're like, well, the protagonist is boy, and there is girl, so obviously he has big goofy crush on her, and is constantly asking for smooches, and it's like, who the fuck is this guy that you're pretending is Link? Link doesn't have a goddamn thought in his head aside from the Mii Channel music, and you're trying to tell me there's a hornball is Link? That said, there's some really funny shit about his characterization. Like, his introduction in episode one is just him complaining, like, oh man, living in this castle is so boring. I miss living out in the woods and eating rocks and shit. It's just like, you know what? I'll accept this characterization.
For a brief moment, they understood him.
He's such a goblin. It's genuinely quite funny. And this version of Zelda is kind of an ass kicker. It fluctuates wildly from episode to episode because sometimes she'll be like saving the day, and sometimes she'll be like, Link, help! And then she'll be like, what are you're supposed to save me? That's your job. And it's just like, yeah, okay, cool. My favorite goofy ass thing in that show is that the good guys have the Triforce of Wisdom, which naturally talks. It gives them helpful tool tips and rhyming couplets. Ganon has the Triforce of Power, and whoever assembles the two Triforces will gain ultimate power and rule the land forever. Only two there are.
The name, right? You know, give no? a little bit of a zhuzh.
Yeah, the Die Force. But no, apparently it was just because the Triforce of Courage wasn't canon in the first Zelda game, so it came up in like Zelda 2 or something. But at the time they made the cartoon, they just didn't know that there was a third part of the Triforce yet.
Oh my god.
Because it just hadn't been canonized.
They couldn't.
It's in the logo!
I know!
The implication of it being named Triforce, that no one put that together.
It's very funny.
I guess I can put myself in their shoes and be like, we see there's a third little triangle in this logo, but we don't know what it's of. So we don't want to take a stab in the dark and miss.
It's very, very... I mean, God knows they took a lot of stabs in the dark and missed with other shit in that show, but it's
not even say like we need to find another piece of the Triforce and just not name what it is. Looking
there's
at the logo,
there's a whole episode where like the Triforce of Wisdom gets accidentally shattered, and I gotta say they take that in stride remarkably well. They're just like, oh no, the Triforce is broken into pieces, and we only have one of them. And then it's just like, this side of the Triforce feels very cold. It feels wet. It fell somewhere that must have water in it, and this side is hot. It must be somewhere hot. And then they go to fucking. There's like one of them's in a lake and one of them is in a volcano, and then they go and find them and then they bring it back and slap it back together and everything's fine. I don't know. It's a baffling experience. I thought it was fascinating. They're all on YouTube, and I was like reading through the comments and they're very complimentary. Like, I got through the final episode and everyone was like, I can't believe Link never got that kiss. And I was like, you guys care this much about that? I don't know. I respect it though. There's some really funny shit though. There were a couple parts where I was like, is this just innocent, goofy banter? Or was this meant for the grown-ups in the audience? I don't know. It doesn't happen often, but there's like an episode where Zelda, like an evil mirror duplicate of Zelda, gets created from a magic mirror and she comes out.
I already
like,
don't like this.
Yeah. She's wearing dark clothing. And obviously, immediately, the first thing she does is give Link a big kiss, because the running gag of the show, the peak of hilarity, is that Link is constantly trying to get Zelda to kiss him. And every time it looks like she's going to, something interrupts, like Ganon attacks, or like a big hole opens in the ground and he falls into it. And he's always like, ah, shucks, why does this always happen? So when evil Zelda kisses him, he's like, whoa, Nelly, I thought this day would never come. He's like, oh, it's kind of colder than I expected. And then she's like, I have a new outfit now. Isn't that fun? And then she like trips him. And then while he's on the ground, she steps on him. And I was like, okay, all right, okay.
Oh, no.
Okay. although I will give that episode 1 point, because when they're like, she's like, take the Triforce. We're going to go attack Ganon right now. Whereas, of course, she's evil. So her plan is like, we're going to bring the Triforce to my master Ganon and yada, yada, yada. And they're like riding along. And he is like, hey, wait a second. This Zelda doesn't have a reflection. And he immediately is like, oh, she's got to be some kind of like evil mirror clone or something of Zelda. So I guess...
You know, the classic.
Yeah. And then he's like, well, you know what? This works out great, because I guess I'll just follow her to wherever they're holding Zelda prisoner, and then I'll get to rescue her and everything will be great. Okay, I guess the plan is just to continue as intended. And I was just like, you know what? I'll give them a single point for not making him be stupid and letting him just be like, oh yeah, one of these situations, you know, it must be Tuesday, I guess.
It's kind of funny, actually.
It's kind of funny. There were a lot of moments where I was like, that's kind of funny. I'll give you that.
Wow.
This is why I love going back to shit that is universally considered to be bad, because it's almost always bad, but there's usually little nuggets of fun stuff in there where I'm like, yes, I could see this being really entertaining. I could see some of this sticking with you. But I'm not surprised that the lasting legacy of this show is just the bad one where Link talks.
What's definitively not bad is the movie Edge of Tomorrow.
True. Yes. That's another benefit of looking up things that people tell you are bad, because frequently you're like, you guys just have shit taste. This is just fine.
Yeah, I didn't have a lot of agency in choosing to watch Edge of Tomorrow last night. My boyfriend walked in, he's like, let's watch Edge of Tomorrow. Very definitively. And I was like, did someone tell you to watch Edge of Tomorrow? Did you see it somewhere? I just haven't thought about that movie in a long time. And he's like, no, let's just watch it.
I was hanging out with Brandon Sanderson and he said it was his second favorite movie of all time.
Second favorite movie of all time. So we did it. It was great. We are coming up on time on the After After Show show. I'd love to continue to talk about Edge of Tomorrow. I'm sure, you know, by next time I'll have another movie. If you have not watched Hundreds of Beavers yet, now is the time. Go watch Hundreds of Beavers. It's really, guys, it's really good. I know people love to, I know what happens every time I recommend something. Is people are like, oh, Indigo's recommending something. It's gonna, you know, she's such a big Speed Racer fan. It's probably like that. No, it's just good, okay? I like Speed Racer for a lot.
So what you're saying is that Speed Racer is not just good.
No, Speed Racer is just good.
What an interesting thing for you to say.
You're just wrong.
But oh, I see.
It has that reputation, because Speed Racer has the reputation of, and in the last couple of years, there's been something of a renaissance for it, where like a lot of people have been coming around on it. But when it first came out, it got the reputation of, this is a silly kids movie. But, you know, obviously it's just very good. Hundreds of Beavers came out now, is just good. People have not heard about it. I am trying to spread the good word. It is a good movie. Just go watch Hundreds of Beavers.
Oh, man.
But yeah, that's time. Blue, you want to take us out?
Yeah, thanks so much for listening to this episode of the After Show Show. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another ass. But in the meantime, we'll have videos up on the channel. Red will maybe do a stream of Link's Awakening Part 2 at some point. Who knows when? Yeah. Up to her scheduling. Patreon is making some changes to the payment format. We had a post on that last week.
It's a good thing to announce.
Scroll down from the Patreon page where you probably are right now, and you've probably already heard us talk about it.
The extreme TLDR is that we're not changing anything until the beginning of next year. But at the beginning of next year, we are going to change from our current billing, which is per creation, which means about once a week, to per month, so about once a month, and the tiers are going to be adjusted correspondingly. Our current plan is that there's the after show is going to go from being an all patrons thing to a $5 tier patrons thing. Practically speaking, this will change very little for any of you, because even if you are already a $1 patron, you already get billed about 4 to 5 times a month, which basically means about $4 or $5. So that's the math works out pretty cleanly. But it doesn't feel good for us to be like, we are jacking up all of our tiers. So it's, thanks Patreon. But we are, you know, thanks Apple. Thanks Patreon, bending the knee to Apple.
We'll have more to say on this in the future as we get closer to the thing. But for now, you can take a look at it if you want.
But for now, nothing will be changing. Nothing changing until 2025.
Yeah. In any case, thanks so much. Good stuff. We'll see y'all next time. Catch you later.
Bye.